it's a, if you want to make the, that homunculus squeamish, Raven Guard's not a bad option.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Ducker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host for the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Red Powell.
Hello.
Tanya Gates and Adam Camilleri.
Hello, hello.
Oh, hey.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you for joining us each and every week. Don't forget to leave some 5-star reviews and like, share, subscribe, and all that kind of stuff. So this past weekend, we had a tournament or did some commentary for a tournament for Games Workshop in Grapevine, Texas at the Warhammer Citadel Cafe.
Yeah, Paul and I were on the ground. Tanya was off gallivanting, smashing her way through an RTT. And I've no idea what Red was doing. What were you doing, Red?
Working.
There you go.
No, I was somebody's actually gotta do it. That's right. Someone's got to do it out of any of us. I was actually driving. I know you've been getting around, Adam, but I didn't make as far of a trip across the pond or anything for you. But I drove from Georgia to Texas, so probably passed through a few places.
It was
a good drive.
Well, it sounds like you made it. Glad to hear it. First time I've been to Grapevine, and it's there. It's a suburb of Dallas. You fly into Dallas, and it was a quick trip from the airport. So if anybody's passing through, go check out the Warhammer Citadel. It's not too far from the airport. You could probably swing it on the way to wherever it is you're going. And I don't know if it's like a one street town, but they certainly have like a main street. I think Main Street.
If there is one street, that's an awesome street. That street was fantastic. It was all lit up. They had a Christmas festival on. And we got shown, like Paul and I got shown nothing but a good time in that town. Really, really well looked after. And me and Paul were there for work as well. Paul in front of the camera, me doing a little bit behind it. And it was a showcase. It was a real showcase of the community, showcase of the game. And, Mike Bratt and the team put on an excellent performance. The Warhammer Citadel. Check it out if you get the chance.
It's cool to see Forge World on the walls. All the artifacts that were around the store. They had obviously some props. And like a Striking Scorpions, Mandiblaster helmet, and Shuriken pistol. I mean, like theater, like movie quality.
They had a probably 30-inch plastic, I'm not sure actually it was plastic or it was mold, plastic Deathwing Terminator just hanging out with a plasma cannon on a plinth. And I was like, I wonder how much that weighs and how fast I could run with it.
You could have gotten those at a period of time. Like that was manufactured.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, I am a sad panda.
check out there. Maybe it's still out. I don't know if it's still out there or not. But I managed to contain myself. I got a couple of stocking stuffers for the family, and I got a exclusive knight head just because.
Cool.
Yeah. I figure why not.
It's from Santa, in air quotes.
Stocking stuffer for myself.
Paul, the cheeky man, we went to the GW HQ there. Like they just have just a beautiful old house that they've converted into an office. And what was there on the wall, mate? And you just kept being like, Adam, can we steal it?
Is anybody going to notice? So they have one of the John Blanche Primarch prints of Sanguinius. And I did not get that when it was out at the time. It was only out for a period of time. I wasn't able to get it, and I still don't have it. I was like, I've been on the hunt for one, and there it was. It's still there, by the way.
Were you also looking?
Looking sideways at it, trying not to caress it. Yeah, it was fun.
Are you also wondering how fast you could run?
I will say, the home office there, pretty cool. It also has a bunch of cool artifacts and prints and artwork, and I'm slightly sad to say that it is still there. But oh my goodness, I want it so bad. Yeah, I have Mortarion, but I don't have Sanguinius. But they're gorgeous. I do hope sincerely that they come out with those again sometime in the future. But the food, so could have eaten my way up and down that street several times.
Yeah, me too. I showed some restraint, but not much.
Yeah. There's a place called Weinberger Cafe. I think that's what it's called. It's you go out of the store and it's like the first, not the first, but it's one of the places right there, just on the corner. You know, within a 2 minute walk, and they have just some amazing sandwiches on their menu. You know, both cold and hot stuff. And a couple of the sandwiches are named after stuff in Warhammer. Like they've had the Gork and Mork sandwich before. The sandwich on the menu now is called the Sigmar.
Nice.
So obviously related. I don't think that's by accident.
No, they know what they're doing. They know what they're about.
Yeah, it was a cool place. You know, the Citadel, check out the coverage on Twitch if you haven't already. We certainly appreciate that. And the people that came in and supported us live during the show. That was awesome. It was really neat to keep everything moving and lively in the chat, and to talk about the games and to talk about the high-level play that we saw. And then casual play, like just for funsies, the players decided to do an Age of Sigmar versus Warhammer 40,000 battle for the folks that were in, like, they had already been eliminated from the competition rounds. Like, you know what? Let's just play our armies versus each other. Let's just, it was completely unofficial. But they just made up some interaction rules and went to town.
You say this was spur of the moment. And the way I choose to see this was combatants staring each other from across the room, meeting in the middle, throwing down the gauntlet, and deciding to find out whose code of play will reign supreme for the next 12 months.
Clashing.
40K AOS. Clashing in the middle. We saw knights versus gargants going toe-to-toe, mano a mano. Knights dying, exploding. Gargants dying and falling on top of knights. Chaos ensued. And 40K came out triumphant. Absolutely mopped the floor with them. We are superior for the next 12 months. When it happens again. And AOS has a chance, once again, to prove they are not lesser, even though we know they are.
I don't know, man. I hate to say it, but like a skink cooked down a Vanguard vet, Blood Angel Vanguard vet.
Just like blow darted right in the seam of the armor. It's like, oh dear, I'm not gonna leave this down.
But it was just neat to see the players just still, after a whole weekend of gaming, wanting to roll more dice. And I was just kind of the spirit of the event. So, I mean, okay, we did a little bit of that coverage more just to show the spectacle that was happening. But it was neat. Let's check it out. But over the weekend, Drukhari went out. That was, I don't think anyone's too surprised at that. But they actually ended up facing off against Kraftworld Eldar in the final. So, you know, a feud as old as time.
Mm-hmm.
And came down to the final rolls of the game.
Yeah, it was a really weird turn of events how that happened. So Brad Chester, those of you who don't know, no need to name drop, but one of the players had an exhibition list that was Mono Kraftworld Eldar. It was a combination of Ulfwe, because he had Eldrad, and then some expert crafters and some goodness there. And he actually went and beat, like, very possibly the best Blood Angels player in the world at the moment, which was very unexpected. And then went on to take, well, first and foremost, that was his exhibition list, playing some exhibition games for some stuff. So GW wrote that list for him as a bit of a showcase list, a bit of homage to a bunch of amazing miniatures in order to put on a great spectacle game for people. And Brad liked it so much, he asked permission of the TOs to use it in the competitive part of the event. And they said yes. And he ended up playing in the finals and almost beat the strongest meta army in the game at the moment. It was phenomenal. And I heartily suggest anybody who's interested in seeing what an old list can still do when you've got a plan, when you're tuned, when you really know what you're doing, go watch that game.
You can't count out the pilot. You know, we talk about list and, you know, certainly talk about strengths of things and combos and efficiency and stuff, but you still got to move those miniatures around.
Yeah, exactly right. And people forget, like, just because, so the issue with Kraftworlds right now is that their durability is like non-existent. You like look at them sideways weird and they just die. All the models just disappear. But their damage output is just fine. It's like just fine if you're tooling your damage output for the right profiles. And when we talk about, you know, things like these high toughness things like Chronos, like racks and things like this, all high toughness with multiple durability buffs. I mean, Brad had a lot of Bright Lances. He had like quite a few Dark Reapers and Shining Spears and Fire Dragons. The guy had, did he have every single...
No Banshees.
No, that's right. No Banshees. But he had everything else. I mean, you can always call the thing Beltan for how diverse it was in Aspect Warriors. And
yeah.
the crazy man made it work, and he made it look good as well.
I miss playing with a bunch of Aspect Warriors. That was back when you could, you know, do the Court of the Young King and just have all Aspect Warriors as troops. That was not kind to my friends, I'll say that. But I enjoyed playing with that because the miniatures were so cool.
Mm.
And come on, who isn't like charging across the field with striking scorpions and fire dragons in the back of Falcons?
So when I was a kid, like really, really, we're going back to right at the beginning. One of the very first, so very, very first time I went into a Games Workshop, I couldn't afford to buy anything because I was, you know, 10 or something. I didn't have any, I had like, you know, the $6 it cost to take the train into the city. And I was just walking around, went to an arcade and, you know, played some Raiden and some Daytona.
And your life has changed forever.
Exactly right. And they gave me one of the Citadel painting catalogs. And it had all the first edition Gaz hanging out in his battle wagon that was just like essentially just a flatbed truck with a bunch of spikes on it. And it had all those Aspect Warriors. It was the same Carandrus and Fugin and all those guys. And I was like, they were the coolest things I'd ever seen at the time. And while I'm not unhappy, I'm unhappy that I haven't gotten updated models, they still evoke something really, really special in me. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be unhappy to play them one day. Like, it'd be really cool.
Yeah. No, putting on basically a show is what Brad did, showing that you could still squeeze some life out of those codexes, which is cool because, hey, we talk about that sometimes. And so it's nice to see it playing out, you know, in the real world example. But it's also, you know, kind of what, because I, you know, it's cool to play, you know, what you should play, you know, what the math says you should play, but also it's cool to play what you want to play. And ultimately that is what this game is about. And it's nice to really see that it can still succeed. I mean, of course you need to sometimes to go your way, but it's actually no different than any game of 40K. So if anybody's working on any fringe stuff, you know, look, keep it going.
There are some updates, you know, there's some updates that can't be that far away that could completely, you know, turn the tables on some of these things we consider not competitive or not, you know, not playable. And of course, like, you know, statistics wise, I'm not sure if people are always tracking it, but statistically, the worst performing army in the game at the moment that has any decent amount of people playing it still, you know, not counting things like Imperial Fist and some of the minor, because Imperial Fist essentially is a sub faction of Space Marines. The actual pure codex that's doing the worst is Gene Steel Occult. That's because people are just don't have much mode of play. So, you know, you think if you're a Gene Steel Cult player, you're about to get a book. And have we talked about the Gene Steel Cult buffs?
No, we have not. And also would want to talk about the missions and the secondaries that were previewed over the weekend too, because I do think that's going to also have an impact on what people consider to be, you know, quote unquote, the most viable.
Mm.
Well, we talked about the cults. Yeah.
Red, Tanya, you guys have seen this? You guys seen the previews? Because, oh man, I find that mechanic so exciting.
Crossfire? Is that what you're talking about?
Like I said before, when Alex McDougall gets really excited about something, then I start to worry a little bit. I think that it's still going to be something that might be a little bit difficult for newer players to kind of like wrap their head around, because I think you're still going to need to, you know, we always say that the game is sort of won and lost in the movement phase. And I think that this mechanic is maybe is going to prove that, because if you can master your movement phase, I think this is going to be extremely powerful.
Let's talk about what the rule does. Let me get it up exactly here off the Warhammer community site. Once an enemy unit has a crossfire marker, it becomes especially vulnerable to attack. First, any further crossfire units shooting them add 1 to their hit rolls. Then if the target is exposed, they're in for a world of hurt. How does one become exposed? If you draw a line from the attacking unit's base to another friendly crossfire model within sight, then that line passes over the targeted unit, that target unit is exposed. Attackers add 1 to their wound roll against the exposed unit. And then if the attackers are within 12 inches of their target, they ignore enemy cover too.
I think this is what I wish all mono faction, you know, special rules were like. This is such an engaging, interesting thematic mechanic for a faction to have. It's also a skill check.
Yeah, like, so you feel like it makes you work for it.
It makes you work for it, man. You have to be good to get this off at a premium time. I mean, not just using it to wipe out screens easier, using it to really neuter the heart and soul of your opponent's army, expose them, draw them out, trap them, bait them, crossfire them. It seems phenomenally cool and exciting. I mean, I think of things like doctrines. I think of things like the protocols for Necrons. And while they're cool, they're thematic, they're interesting themselves, I feel like they're that exciting. Like they really just feel like I've got all this agency, and if I play better on the table, I just get more out of my book again and again, and there's different levels of how much I get out of it. I feel like this is a weird, if I was to read this mechanic outright without any context, just by itself in a vacuum, I'd be like, oh, Tau getting different marker lights. Is that what you guys see as well?
Oh, being able to spin things. Well, it goes on to also say that you can even upgrade one of your units to be able to use the crossfire rule as soon as they arrive from reinforcements, meaning that your enemies are never safe from gene stealer cults. So I guess it's implying there that gene stealer cults are still going to be able to have their kind of pop out of nowhere, come out of the shadows types of abilities, which is pretty good.
What do you think, Red? This mechanic seems like it's right up your alley.
Yeah, I mean, it's so up my alley that I'll just go ahead and, you know, shake the salt off a little bit here. That, like, it's such a good mechanic that I honestly wish it was like a inherent game mechanic.
Just a base rule. Like if you were able to get your opponents in this situation, then you get.
Because it's so, like, it's such a good mechanic. The way that it's designed and kind of the element to it that, I mean, what do, and I get it, like, you can read the flavor text, you can read the article, which is great and all, but you're telling me Space Marines can't pull this off?
That was one of the things that was, like, one of the only criticisms that I've seen is, like, oh, so you're saying that the Custodes can't figure out how to crossfire? No, it's implying that everyone crossfires. Like, the game is, I mean, we have advanced targeters. Everyone is firing and everyone is, you know, you could beam something down from orbit with fairly pinpoint accuracy kind of thing. But this is just, the gene stealer cults are able to pull off this type of maneuver.
Yeah, because they're of one mind, right? Like, it's a hive mind deal and they can pull it off. It's cool. There's my salt. I got it on my system. to this mechanic, though, I really do, like, I think that I've mentioned before, like, the way, minus some of the other stuff that's clearly, you know, whether it's some psyker business or whatever, some of the flair that very much makes it a gene stealer kind of deal. I mean, the abominations and the mutants and whatnot, for sure. For me, it absolutely has all the elements that I would love to, like, take my Tanith models and play it under that concept of being able to, like, pop them up here or there. Yeah, I've mentioned it before, right? And so just to take this tactic, like crossfire, and be able to play it like that, like, it absolutely plays into that. I think that this is way better than, say, like Speedwog. Okay, so you kill a unit and then all of a sudden everyone else gets +1 to hit. This little mechanism, and like you were saying, the skill check aspect of it, I think that skill check aspect plays absolutely into the fact of how this is a war game. And you want to try and achieve those conditions because that's why you maneuver, right? There's a difference. I've talked about this before. There's a difference between movement and maneuver. Mm-hmm. You just move to get somewhere. You maneuver so that you have an advantageous position in order to execute tactical action, right? And so you want to maneuver your forces appropriately so that you can actually achieve the crossfire effect. And I think that's huge. And I think that it is adding additional layers to the game more than just, we kill this person, so you get an additional bonus, which I don't disagree with. I mean, you know, I love watching Korn turn it up to 11 after I've killed a character or something. But at the same time, this is the kind of war game mechanic that, as you mentioned, Adam, I will lean into 1,000% if you give me an opportunity.
I'd like to know more so I can figure out how often this will be able to occur. Because it's not often that I think you're going to find yourself in this spot, and probably not by accident when it does occur.
Yeah.
So, right, going back to that skill check. You know, I need to know if I need to glue some third arms on my catechins.
I would. No, but this is phenomenally cool. This is wonderful and an amazing buff. Because we talked about the Custodes ones last week, and they're just as thematic and amazing. But I feel like this is just what I wish every books one was, where the reward isn't innate; it's a reward by dint of execution. And I do love it when Red talks shop. Like, it just tickles me nicely when he talks about tactical acumen and all that good stuff. And you know,
one of the reasons I like this is with the example that they give on the website here is that it's got a Ridge Runner giving this effect to a unit of pure strains or whatever they are. So it looks like it might function with any unit. So that might factor into how you design your list. You might have units you intend to, I don't want to say sacrifice, but throw away in order to set up this type of situation. Sacrifice, I think that's actually a pretty cool mechanic. I think it's going to influence list design. And I don't know, it just seems powerful, but not in a way that is, over the top because there's going to be this trade aspect involved. Yeah, probably, I agree. Practically the case, but we shall see.
I'm like a horrible person to be like asking about Gene Stealer cult stuff because I'm like, I'm afraid of all of it. I have a healthy respect for it.
That's one of your playtest partners is a big Hotline player.
Arguably one of the biggest, yeah.
Yeah. He's a juggernaut of the faction.
Yeah. So I hear everybody else like talking trash about them. I'm like, but have you seen what they can do?
Reading further in the article, in the Perfect Ambush, the proficient planning thing, it does say crossfire is a keyword units only. So I guess it's conceivable that there are some units that are not crossfire units. But from the example, I don't even know if you have to maybe, you know, who knows? We'll see if it's a crossfire unit can be across from any Gene Stealer cult, any friendly model. We'll see.
It could be everything to include guys on ATVs or whatever, you know, like some other codexes, or it could be like four or five units. Can I still do that now that Necrons have more core, or am I not allowed to take that position?
Yeah, you can have it. I think that one's probably in there to exclude things rather than include things. It's probably there to prevent you from having things like Brood Brothers Scions in it just come down and auto-give you.
For sure.
That kind of stuff, possibly.
Now, who knows? It's going to be cool to see how this kind of shakes out because, you know, we know it has tricks. It's going to have tricks. And then how it shakes up the meta, and I'm using air quotes at the moment, because of those deployment shenanigans that we can surely expect. Surprise tactics. Get you in a crossfire.
Tanya, did you play in your very first event with Custodes this weekend?
Yeah, it was my first event that I've done in over a year. And it was my first, because it's an RTT, it was my first three games with Custodes.
Nice. Do we want to get a breakdown? I don't know.
Was it pure Custodes?
Yep. Yeah.
What was in the list?
Yeah. So I was kind of limited to what I have because I bought a whole bunch of stuff secondhand. So I had the juiced up shield captain on Dawn Eagle jet bike with like the 2+, 3+, 5+, feel no pain, extra wounds, you know, all the stuff. I had a regular shield captain. I had four units of sword and board, like the sword and shield custodian guards. So it was 4-4-3
or whatever they are.
Yeah, so 4-4-3. I had a unit of three terminators. I had the Vexillus with the +1 attack banner, and I had three of the jet bikes and two telemons.
Two telemons. You're going easy on them.
That's right. If I had three, I would have taken an extra one.
Yeah. So how'd it work out? What'd you play? What were the like first, second, third round?
First round, I actually played against Chaos Space Marines, but it's a very competent player who I had actually never beaten before. So it was pretty good. And that was a really close game. I think it was like I won that one 69-55. And then my second matchup was against Death Guard. It was like three Plague Burst Crawlers, a big Terminator blob and all that stuff. And that one was a 5-point game. So I ended up winning it by 5 points. And then my third...
That's a stout arm.
The Telemons did a lot of work in that one, let me tell you. And I just avoided the Terminators. I was just like, hey, you're slow. I'll just stay away from you and just play the mission. So, yeah, I won that one by 5 points. And then since I won my first two, my third match was against Alex McDougall. And so,
we know how that one went.
I lost that one by 4 points. But we had a really, really fun game. And he was just like teasing me the entire time about how I was really good at rolling ones.
Oh, such kindness playing a Custodes on.
Yeah. Oh, it's anything but. That's the surest way to roll some more ones is say anything but a one. It's almost like you're summoning those ones from the void.
Yeah. So it was like actually my best showing that I ever had at a tournament. And it was really good for me because I've been struggling with guard for like 2 years. And I'm just at this point because I do still feel like I'm a developing player. So I'm still at this point where I'm not too sure until last weekend, I wasn't sure how much of my struggles was just because I wasn't like playing the mission or I didn't know what I was doing and like how much of it was my faction holding me back. And I think after the weekend now I realize like it really is my faction that's been holding me back a lot. So sorry, Red.
It's okay. Maybe I need to do a little introspection too. Maybe I'm being held back.
No, mixing it up. I mean, really, you got it. I mean, I do think that the general enjoyment of playing the game helps you stay focused on the game to find more angles to, you know, maybe your own like personal morale and, you know, during the game, I think that's a huge deal. And if changing it up and getting some more modern rules helps.
Think of it like this, Tanya. You're like Goku. You've just been training in like 100 times gravity.
Yeah.
Love it. Maybe you're not wrong.
Sure. You were trying to figure out how to play the game at a different angle that may not have been the most up to date and therefore maybe in some regards not the most competitive. And now you're picking up something, especially as we head towards the Codex, that you can really take advantage of it. And so you learn the game from certain aspects and now you're able to, that's why it's important to hear, you know, your perspective in comparison to some of our old dog perspectives in regards of just a new look at some of the things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for this being your first RTT taking the custodes out and for how you did and everything, I mean, clearly you have mechanics of the game down, you have an approach to it, you have a mindset for the objectives, and so you just now have different assets and capabilities, and maybe you don't go into it like other people might have had they been playing that the whole time.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe people who had been playing a faction that had a little bit more power in it, they might have been trying to go for kills more than anything, but because I played a faction that really struggled to kill a lot of things in some games, because you're really relying on good dice rolls, I think for 2 years I've had to really focus on learning how to play the mission, right? Mm. Like I could never take kill secondary at all with guard, because you're just never guaranteed that you will actually be able to kill what you need to. So, I mean, I think I took that and then like that mindset, and then the Telemons are really, really killy, not in their shooting, but in their melee, they're super, super killy. So, it was really interesting to see like, oh, wow, like I do have some tools now in which to actually, not only play the mission better because the sword and board custodians can hold objectives extremely well, but now I can also kill things that would have been nigh impossible to kill before.
I'm digging.
See, but that like revelation of going through that, I mean, there is something to be said for that, because it's not just having like grown through it. 100 times gravity, Tanya, you did it.
Yeah, and like I was always planning on making this jump to the custodes. I just wanted to wait until the new book came, but it just became really clear last week that in order for morale to improve, I really needed to just start playing them now. So, yeah, I'm excited for what 2022 has to bring with my new year, new army.
Oh, my goodness. Don't say 2022. We just started 2021, it feels like.
Time has no peace.
I still haven't gotten over 2020. Yeah.
It is. I remember. So we have a small chalkboard in the in our kitchen area. And I wrote 2021, but I spelled it one, WX. Great year. We actually been a good year. But I still look at that draw. It's still there. I had fully expected to change it seasonally or whatever, and it's still there from January. Because that's just, it just seems like this has been, it's kind of gone by fast, mm-hmm. which is probably a good thing, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have our year in review probably after the first of the year.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But well, yeah, we're here in December. Wow. It's crazy. But anyway, I'm glad you got out there and played some games. And I was a good time. Did you have...
I did have a good time. My first game was like a little bit rough. But then my second round opponent was very kind, and it was probably like the first time that I have been recognized out in the wild, air quotes.
You're like the Yukon.
almost. But like it was just funny. Like, oh, I listened to you on the podcast. It's really nice to meet you. And I was like, oh, this is awkward feeling a little bit, but nice to meet you too.
Oh, well, thanks for listening. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And then third round against Alex is always a great time because he's one of my favorite opponents ever. So
I'm still slugging away on these Death Guard. I painted a little bit more today. Every bro stroke counts. I don't know if we're going to actually do a real full on finishing moves this episode, but just want to remind everybody that even if you get just a little bit done, it's a little bit you don't have to do anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm not feeling doing the hobby, I'll just go and I'll sit down in my hobby station and just like look at my projects that I have on the go. And I'll just do like one little thing and that still counts, you know?
It does. Today I realized that, so the sides on the Destrial Terminators, they have a hand wraps, and at the start and the end of the hand wraps is a little metal bit of some kind. I forgot to paint the metal bit at the top of the hand wraps. So I'm
going to start all over. Strip the bottom.
That's right.
Yeah, strip them. In fact, don't even bother. Just sell them and buy new ones. Don't point out the flaw.
I couldn't do that to somebody. It would keep me up at night if I knew that they were out there thinking they had a fully painted model and they didn't.
I was going to say, when you sell them, you got to say, I got so far and then realized that I didn't paint these pipes and they need a new home.
That's some sanguineous conscience right there. Right there.
Who hasn't felt that way, though? Like... That's it. Just gotta stop. But that's it. That's why you gotta keep going, because it's gonna be rewarding. And I thought, as I'm going through, it's a journey here. I mean, I haven't bitten off more than I can chew. I know that. But you know, when you're looking until I get these bases on there, they're just a mass of green, and you're gonna look like, man, did I even do anything today? And just every brushstroke you do is a brushstroke you don't have to do in the future. And if a part of the model is irritating you, then paint it now while you're thinking about it. Or if there's a part you're excited about doing, then do it. Because, you know, we've talked about in the past, motivation is not something you can rely on to always carry you through. You have to have, you know, some other tricks to make sure you get it done. And that's what I'm doing with these.
So my custodies that I bought, I have a few things, like a few Forge World things in the mail. And other than that, everything else that I bought is secondhand. So it's a bit of like a rescue project. I have to tear everything down and then basically rebuild it all. But I don't think that I'm actually going to strip it. I think I'm just going to reprime and go over it. I've never been able to get like a model stripped to a point where I'd be happy with it.
Yeah.
I really do feel that like once your models are painted and based and they're all together and they look cohesive, I don't think anybody's going to notice if there's like a little bit of texture from like a little bit of like extra paint underneath your primer. So
100% on that. Like I don't think I've ever been happier with a stripped model than I have a repainting of a model. Ever. And this is back, you know, stripping's, everyone has their own different strip recipe or techniques. And I've tried several of them in the past. I haven't done it probably in a decade or more, because I was just never happy with the result of stripping.
So, So I'm excited to see how this project goes, because I've never actually done like a renovation of somebody's old army before. So cross your fingers. Yeah. Cross your fingers for me. Some of those models are super rough, so I'm really interested to see what I can do with them.
Okay, good luck. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we will talk more about this episode. See you all in a minute.
See ya.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Redheaded Jump, but it's still Tanya and Adam here.
Hey, everybody.
Can anything stop Drukhari?
Tanya.
No.
Somebody, phone a friend. Get out.
Really was.
So I think the way that you answer that is you have to identify exactly why Drukhari are so dominant. And I, since, as we said before, I'm just learning, if you guys could fill me in on that, then maybe I could formulate a better opinion.
Sure. So what they're really good at a couple of different builds in the game. And And they also have really great maneuverability. So they have the ability to take a bunch of small units that you still have to dedicate resources, time out of your army, time out of your turn, round in the game to deal with. They can trade on and off objectives. And so that, again, just really efficient as far as like the points go. And then you can also take a version, which we saw this past weekend, that's actually a build that has existed for a long time, just become more prevalent as they had some slight tweaks in the balance update, which is a build relying heavily on Talos and Kronos, which are high toughness, high number of wounds models. They have this power from pain track that on starting in turn two, they can most of the army, basically the entire army, can assault, advance and charge units that do not normally get that ability, get that for power from pain.
Correct. So there's like Paul said, there's still right now, even after the balance change updates, there's still a very potent MSU army, but it's no longer their best mode of play because they have this extremely durable fallback core that actually got some points reductions in that same balance update. So they went from having things like Talos and Kronos and Grotesques and Racks being very powerful and very good for the points, but now they're actually quite cheap per wound for what you get. Because so first and foremost, it operates around a single buff that's put out by Homunculus, which is the HQ for the Covens, which is an aura of increased toughness, plus one toughness. And as a big break point in the game, when you take a Rack, which is toughness 4, to toughness 5, take a Grotesque from toughness 5 to toughness 6, and then taking Talos and Kronos from toughness 6 to toughness 7, all those three increases are exponential durability increases. And then you have the caveat that you have either Dark Technomancers, which is very well known, that increases the damage output of things like Kronos, or you have Artists of Flesh, which gives the entire list a minus one damage buff. Now,
it sounds gross also.
Well, here's the double down effect. You have a feel no pain element to this. Every single one of the units I just reeled off, after it's failed a save, whether that be its armor save or its invulnerable save for people following over at home, gets to roll a 5+ to see if it just ignores the fact it failed that save for whatever damage it is. Like if you've taken 6 damage from a multi-melter, after you've failed that invulnerable save or armor save, should you have one, you roll 6 dice and on a 5+, that wound's ignored. So then when you minus one to that dice already, and then you take a third of those ones that make it out of there on top, then you add in the fact that is it turn three or turn four you get the 5+ invulnerable save from the power from pain.
That's a progression chart. So the power from pain chart progresses as the turns progress, and so they get slightly little incremental buffs each turn of the game. They're all cumulative. You don't lose them, you gain them all as the rounds go on.
And so what's really happening now is that they've gone from being the fastest, most dynamic army that just had more resources than you in order to trade and control objectives and play the board, to being incredibly imposing, dominant, and like an unstoppable force that will just come at you. It's not necessarily that killy. They're not as killy as some of the really big damage outputting armies out there, but they're still very respectable, extremely, extremely durable, and they're quicker than you think. Because most of the things I just reeled off, the Talos, the Kronos, have fly, have above average, like above the average of 6-inch move, and then they get the advance and charge. And so they're quicker than usual, they fight better than average, and they are extremely durable. And so you just get this, it's a mountain of issues to unpack.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously we can see that none of the current factions proven that they can consistently deal with this. So it would have to be a faction that is fast, probably has shenanigans, and is also has more damage output, essentially.
Yeah, so right now I'm in Florida with some very, very good players. I'm hanging around picking their brains, and we're trying to coalesce into a solution that isn't just, well, I guess we're taking the same thing, you know? I guess, well, because if you can't beat them, join them.
That's a valid tactic, by the way. You can't beat them, join them. You go into a tournament, you're trying to win the thing, you take whatever the best is. It happens in Magic all the time. People brew and they come to a conclusion that XYZ deck is the best, and then their entire team takes it.
If you're a basketball player and you knew that guy over there, who's like the star of the Chicago Bulls, has shoes that make him jump an extra 2 inches or sprint an extra like 1 second faster on a beep test or whatever, you're telling me you wouldn't wear those shoes or go out and buy those shoes? Like, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but there are some parallels between, you know, sports and what we do. But there's a couple of things here. So the two ways I consider beating it. So the obvious thing is they're too imposing and they're too numerous, really, for you to play MSU into them. Because you'd be like, oh, well, you could just do what Drakkari did to everybody else to Drakkari now. You could just play a sister's army that's ultra dynamic and it's got little units here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, so they can trade, but they never trade up on the points or the efficacy. And, you know, that might very well be a good solution.
That's another thing we talk about trading, just to jump into its level set, is that a 65-point unit can go and take out a 150-point unit from another army. That can happen with many armies. It just routinely happens with Drakkari.
Yeah, Drakkari was just the epitome of that example. Now, there's a couple of ways you want to coalesce if you're trying to bridge the gap. And like I talk about bridging the gap. I mean, this wouldn't be the best army in the game if there was a great solution for it, obviously. You know, we would just be talking about, oh, here's a solution. Here you go. Have everybody. There are a couple of things. I would like to point out that there are some great armies in the game that have been much maligned. I'm talking Tyranids right now, that have quite a good game into them. The issue is the stuff that you throw out there to do damage to them, if it swings and it misses, gets picked up by the Drakkari army extremely easily. Like that, you throw out a couple of gene stealer quad of the 12 to 15, 18 guys. If it doesn't land, it's just dead. You know, it's a bit of yikes. But things like Hive Guard are extremely good here. The fact that you can re-roll the damage. And so usually one thing that's bad about the game, and I said this the other day, a couple of episodes ago, I'm like, the GW developers, you know, heard everybody lamenting the fact that everyone has D3 damage weapons. Oh, it's so inconsistent. We hate it. We just want flat two. And then they put so much flat two damage in the game and changed all the D3s to flat twos and then put minus one damage everywhere and laughed and laughed and laughed.
It is not technically everywhere, but it's some things that people gravitate to when they're looking to capitalize on the fact that everyone started taking the D2 weapons.
Exactly. It's one of the best defensive buffs in the game, like hands down. I think only like minus one to wound or, you know, transhuman equivalent things really put that, you know, make that look ordinary. Mm-hmm. But with this, with the kind of combat them, I always talk about like trying to find the right profiles to go into them. Now, you can look at that minus one damage as being a reason why it makes high quality shots and things bad. Like, it obviously makes damage too bad, but it doesn't make damage.
Yeah, if you're paying a premium for damage too, then that's not going to be efficient going into this army.
So the two things you want to look at is either you want to get a huge amount of you know, medium level strength attacks, you know, the strength fives, the strength sixes, things like assault cannons, if you can get some better rend on your equivalents. I really like the T-Suns weapons, like, you know, with the
rotor,
like,
cannons.
So good. The Soul Reaver cannons. Because they're strength six, so, you know, they're not great. They're phenomenally good at shredding grotesques and racks. But when you need to, you can play a couple CP for Veterans of the Long War, or their 2 CP equivalent now in T-Suns, and just shoot those guns into Talos and do, you know, take a pound of flesh. And because it's all one damage, you know, their minus one damage doesn't mean a thing. The other way you could look at it is if they're all, you can try and spike the other end of the equation. Like, oh, cool, if they're all minus one damage, what's the biggest damage shot I can lay at these guys? Things like multi-melters, las cannons, D3 plus threes, D6 plus twos. You know, how many of these can I literally just put down their throat?
And overcharge plasma cannons.
Yeah, stuff like that. I mean, damage three going damage two is bad, but it's not that bad. And then you can, if you wanted to, Paul, you could look at something like Weapons of the Dark Age for Dark Angels, go to damage four down to damage three. Nothing wrong with that at all. Or you can look at something like White Scars. And I've been thinking about White Scars quite a bit in this realm, because people think of like, oh, White Scars are bad because they've got plus one damage, but, you know, they get negated by their minus one damage. Well, my plus one, why don't we flip that on its head? My plus one damage negates their minus one damage.
It does, you know, sound like a mathematical wash to me.
Yeah, it's a wash. So what's the big deal? I'm better into it than, you know, unfortunately, things like Sangard. You know, Sangard going from damage two to damage one is the worst of these interactions. But things like Vanguard Vets are quite respectable, because you get especially if you've got a chappy nearby, give him plus one to wound when they go into that combat, wounding on fours, re-rolling. That's exceptionally good because you can mass a bunch of attacks. And in that example, Blood Angels are probably the best one, or say maybe a Space Wolf successor that gets double exploding sixes with Whirlwinds of Rage and the Savage Echoes, is it? Or Savage Fury in the Assault Doctrine. Mm-hmm. That could be really good for a bunch of exploding and doubling down on your efficiencies and just the sheer amount of quantity of attacks you can put on them.
Yeah, rolling in there with a bunch of chain swords is probably not bad.
Yeah. I mean, lightning claws is my preference, but a bucket of chain swords, just mass attacks into racks, I don't mind at all. Especially, I think Blood Angels are the best ones at that, for sure, because the plus one to wound, you know, gets around the issues with their toughness five. So if you just go in there, I even think, like, just if you just want to throw away a big unit of Death Company that's only got a couple of hammers. And so, you know, if you get the hammers to connect on the big stuff, and then all the other mooks can go in with just like, was it five or six attacks each?
Yeah, it's about six, depending on when you're making your swings or which other things you've done. It can be a lot, but we've actually seen Space Wolves on the rise, and they have a lot of these, you know, kind of bonus attack type stuff too.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, well, I was mentioning a lot of Space Wolves now are taking the Space Wolf successes because they're finding that people have gotten quite good at playing around heroic intervention and learning ways and means to avoid it. There are ways that the Space Wolf player can have a lot of agency. You place yourself in the right position on an objective, and it's just, well, too bad. If you want this objective, you got to go through me. But, you know, people have figured out ways and means of getting around. So I see a lot of Space Wolves players playing the Whirlwind of Rage, Born Heroes combination. Mm-hmm. And what that gives you is on the charge, you have exploding sixes to hit. So every six that you roll is another additional hit automatically. And then you get plus one to hit on the charge as well. And so what that does is it makes up for the fact that you don't have that anymore for being Space Wolves. And it gives you great efficiencies for things that have minus one to hit. Say, if your opponent's innately minus one to hit for whatever reason, lightning fast reactions or whatnot, or you're taking a Thunderhammer or a Power Fist. Gives you a lot of agency there. And then you go in with, like, you know, Chaplain rerolls. And you can, if you want, because you're hitting on twos, pick up everything that's not a six and roll it all again. And just fish as many sixes as you can out of that interaction as you want. And it can be really quite powerful.
Yeah, I think getting for some of these armies, like, getting to the matchup is the struggle.
That's very true. I suppose that's where Tanya may have been in the past playing guard. It was not a matchup you generally saw happening very often, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we're talking about being in this tournament setting, and we're talking about what is the perfect counter for XYZ thing. But then if you never get in the situation or you're never in the success bracket to play them, then is it really worth changing your list up?
Yeah, is it worth stressing about it, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
I always like people to go to a couple of events and find out the matchups that cause them issues. Like, what is the ceiling? What's the matchup or the type of army that is holding you down? And that's the one you should be practicing into, teching your army into.
When playing guard, that was like, and talking to people about, like, the matchups and stuff, a lot of times what I would hear is like, oh, that's just a really bad matchup for you. But after a while, it just seemed like they were saying every matchup was a really bad matchup for guard. And I was like, okay. I mean, I see where you're going here. There's some Chaos-based Marine lists that we'll probably do okay against, but it's really bad for morale.
And like, well, we're talking about, like, Tekken list into things. Like, what do you, if for people that it may be struggling against Drukhari or think that is the menace of their local area, or what they'll face in round three, you know, there's the path of, well, you know, is the compromise you're making in your list going to make you, you know, less likely to even get to the round to where you do face them, or do you legitimately have some things in your army that you could mix it up for, and then what are those things to look for? I think that's the question here.
So I've actually played two games against Drukhari, and I do actually think that Guard have a few ways to deal with, well, I don't know about, like, the new Thick City build with, like, all the Talos and Kronos and stuff like that, but the original Drukhari sort of bad guy list that was like Raiders full of, like, cheap units to trade or whatever, surprisingly, I think Guard had the stuff to deal with that, because you had Lehman Russes that could pop those transports open, and then on your fast Chimera, like, chassis tanks, you could take Flamers. which could clear a lot of that really cheap infantry fairly easily. But yeah, I haven't gotten the chance to play against this new, like, really tough Drukhari list, so I don't even know what I would bring in order to deal with that. I mean, Demolisher cannons maybe, because I might spike the sixes to, or the D6s to deal with the minus one.
And that's the thing.
But
that's oh my
guard,
goodness.
Though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they're close. They're too close, and you're too close.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you either want to play a bunch of like low impact, cheap melters, like vet squads, mm-hmm. special weapon squads, scions, just melter. Or you want to play the kind of traditional guard, like mech and screen thing, where you have your manticores and your battle tanks, and then you're just throwing out waves of useless infantry to slow them down.
Yeah.
The only issue is in the current game, unless you're perfect with your roadblocks for your infantry, all you do them is giving them a leapfrog point where mm-hmm. they can use all their charge moves, essentially to give them a second move. And it's like you have to, there's so much onus on you, the person who's trying to roadblock them, to do it perfectly mm-hmm. that it just becomes such a, you just stuff it up once and your whole game's kind of wrecked.
And it's so depressing to know that you have one chance, and as soon as you muck it up, there's no chance of coming back. And then you watch like a player that has just like a more forgiving army come in and make so many mistakes, and you can't do anything to capitalize on them at that point. And it's so frustrating.
I can feel you on that. So I guess what we're saying is there doesn't seem to be a great answer to that that more durable build, unless you can figure out a way to mount up a ton of basically low point cost damage one, or some long range damage three or better firepower.
Wouldn't it be funny if Gene Stealer Cult came out and like, with the crossfire mechanic and all of their speedy units and their sneaky shenanigans, and they had all of the tools to like dethrone Drukhari. Wouldn't that be funny?
I'm just trying to think about like Baneblade variants that might have those weapon profiles.
So there is one that shoots like a melter equivalent. I think is it the Bane Hammer? It's the Storm Bane something. Cool wrench, that one. You know what that one it is.
Shadow wrench.
I think it's 2d6 like super melter shots. I think they're strength 9 or strength 10. And that one could be quite sassy. If you could deploy it in every deployment map, that would be great. It's like scouting and like, yes, I don't get to use a 10-1. What was the point of bringing?
They're big boys.
So how did they get the Talos and Kronos where they need to go? Are they super fast? They could just get there on their own, or like what's the delivery system for that?
So they fly firstly. They can negotiate terrain quite well.
They're not incredibly fast, but they have a few things going for them.
Yeah. They all have guns. So they get to fire in phase. So essentially they could get a little slingshot if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then of course they have the advance and charge. So they do have
starting turn two.
Yeah, they do have more movement increasing mechanics than most. The advance and charge being the biggest one. Like that's just Drukhari bread and butter right there.
Mm-hmm. So like if you could slow them down, would that perhaps be a way that you could deal with them? Like,
yeah, if you could buy yourself another turn.
Or something like that.
Most armies are overwhelmed by turn two because of the rolling thunder flying.
Well, so they've got a secondary as well that plays really, really phenomenally well into this, called Herd the Prey. Mm-hmm. And so whenever they keep you out of a table quarter at the end of their turn, so they have the opportunity to kill you out of a quarter or address the issue. And then if you're not in at that table quarter, they get 2 points. Now, there are an army that is so hard to be aggressive into, lest they collapse upon you and just like surround you, pull you down. That's just such a good secondary thing to play. In addition, I do really like where you're going with that, Tanya. Like if you had a good way of halving the move on the squads, but the issue is they've got a lot of those mechanics don't work on things with the fly keyword already. And then second to that, they usually got two or three squads of the thing. So you're only you're bleeding out to slow down one of those assets.
Gotcha.
Another.
I wish though, that'd be a great solution.
A decent counter, I think, is Grey Knights. I know we haven't talked too much about them.
Yeah, well, Grey Knights have a couple of solutions as well. I think they've got a psychic power that gives them +1 damage, +1 to wound. Is that correct?
I think it's two, but yes, you can buff them up. Yeah.
Yeah. So that solves a lot of your problems. I also think that there's a thing for trying to snipe out the homunculus. I was trying to think of because I know T-Sons have some mortal. They can just look at that guy if they can get clear lines of sight and just a couple of psychers enraged. It'd be like six mortal wounds to you, mate. Let's see if you can make those five ups, and the next turn they can do it again if the dude survives.
That's one of those things, though. I don't know that you get to have that matchup currently.
That's true. You're not always in a position to make it happen. I really wish Vindicares were better. Like, I wish I could be like, take two Vindicare assassins, everybody, and that guy can't peek out from any of the rockies hiding under.
What we need is some heretical assassins.
That is true. That would be good.
I guess that's technically what the targeting psychic powers from the Thousand Suns could be.
Yeah, it does kind of function as a sniping mechanic, doesn't it? There's a couple of others. Like, Nids can't do enough targeted smites, I don't believe. They do enough smites, but they can't do enough targeted mortals. I was actually looking at a little bit. I was looking for Raven Guard. Like, Raven Guard Eliminators. Just taking two squads is enough to just... And they're already really good in Raven Guard, of course, because in Tactical Doctrine, you get +1 to hit and +1 to wound against characters.
Character models, yeah. It's pretty strong.
Yeah, it's quite strong there. And then, of course, on sixes to hit, you'll get a mortal wound as well. So I thought maybe, because it's only 180 points, and I watched it. So a gentleman brought a pure Raven Guard force to the tournament on the weekend and created. There was a game with his Blood Angels. We gotta gush over this. There was a game, one of the most cinematic things that has happened in 40K in many a moon. All right, so it's Raven Guard versus Blood Angels, and they've been tearing each other apart. The Raven Guard deployed quite defensively and ceded the board to the Blood Angels. The Blood Angels came up with this big red wave, took all the objectives, disrupted the scoring, you know, got up in the middle of the board. It's like, come at me, bro. Let's throw down. And the Raven Guard answered. They went out and they took them apart, and the Raven Guard was smacking them about. And at the end of turn three or turn four, I can't remember which one it was, there was just a couple of characters left for the Blood Angels. Like, the Raven Guard had really slaughtered them back, but the scoreboard was so heavily in the Blood Angels' favor that they needed to scramble for every little point in order to bridge the gap. And it came down to there was this beautiful crux moment. It was so good. It was Shrike, chapter master of the Raven Guard. Yeah, one wound left. Yeah, he'd been through the wars. He'd been fighting for hours against these, you know, his brothers in arms had just gone a bit crazy. You know, with the red shirts. Just yeah. and then Dante, the venerable Dante, the legend, one wound left. Shrike charges him. Well, firstly, Shrike tries to shoot him. And, you know, Dante cold clocks his 4+ invulnerable save. Nah, mate, you're not going to get me like that. We gotta do this properly. Charges in to Dante, swings. Dante's got one wound left, both battered and beaten, just kills him. And Dante's like, I have this secret ability, lets me fight on death for free. I'm taking you with me. And cuts off Strike's head just as his second heart stops. It was the best. It was great.
When they both got removed from... Because we caught that moment on camera. When they both got removed from the table, it was quite epic.
It was phenomenal. It was a moment in time. Those things happen so infrequently in like an actual pitched battle where both players are trying to win that you just got to stop and like step back and be like, this is what this is all about. This is the stuff that made me lose my mind as a 12-year-old about this game. And guess what? I still lose my mind.
Yeah, I cannot agree more.
Oh, it's so good. Sorry. Let's continue.
So Raven Guard take out Drukhari is what you're saying.
If you want to make that homunculus squeamish, Raven Guard's not a bad option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of seems to go in cycles. It's like sometimes snipers in the sniper effect, being able to target characters, even though they're normally would be protected because of the lookout sort of rule, seems to kind of come in and out of fashion somewhat. I mean, almost as the seasons turn.
Yeah. And it's weird how kind of, like, building on that, it's weird how kind of cyclical the competitive meta has been. Remember at the start of 8th edition, sorry, start of 9th edition, at the very start, we got Necrons, which were numerous, like almost a horde-esque, because, you know, J-Dub managed to make the phalanx of Necron warriors, a really palatable part of the army. And so we had this durability kind of element.
I like seeing
element.
That, actually. I like seeing that.
I loved seeing like that wall of, you know, 40, 60, 80 Necron warriors and just feeling like that's really imposing. That's up to the problem. And then we went from there into the Space Marines, especially which became quite elite. And then the Dark Angels and the Death Guard, which were both extreme durability armies. And then Drukhari came out and we really, really went away from that. Then we had the Sisters came out as well, both really heavy MSU armies, quick, dynamic, explosive, exciting, Miracle Dice are crazy. And now we've kind of come full circle. The first one that changed it really I think was Orcs, when the Orcs came out, and that buggy list, which all was very durability based, high toughness, lots of wounds, minus one to wound. Everything can have a 5+ invulnerable save for one turn of the game, thanks to a big old KFF. And now that trend's just continuing. So I wonder if we do come back to it. Like you said, Tanya, perfect segue. Is Gene Steelcock going to tilt us back into that MSU more numerous part of the game, or are we here to stay with the thickness?
That is the question. Right now, if you can, and the terrain also has a big thing to do with that too. And right now, the durability, you can rely on it even if your dice go cold. And so it's kind of daunting to go into. That's why I think it's a worthy thought exercise to figure out what matches up really well into it. And it seems to be a mix of stuff that may struggle to actually find, get it to the dance with that, and things that might, I mean, I guess that's just it. Stuff that weakens you against the other armies. Is that kind of like a hallmark of a healthy meta?
Yeah, that is a good call. And I think it's only going to be in hindsight whether we figure it out. I mean, there's in the tale of 8th edition and 9th edition, suppose we could call that, you know, quotation marks, the modern game, when Gino's been very active in keeping their finger on the, you know, the cross in the teeth and dot in the eyes. I think it's only going to be in hindsight whether we can say, but I would say for the vast majority of these last almost 5 years, there has been a best army or a best couple of armies in the game. And it's just been a kind of a moving goalpost or landscape around that. That's not a bad thing, guys, by any chance, by any stretch of the imagination. Sometimes it's been an issue. Like, there has been some armies that have been so overwhelmingly tuned that there's not a lot of agency left for others. And we just left one of those, I think. See, here's the thing, though. People complain about the Drakari build and some of the other things, but at least you get to play five games, you know, 5 turns of a game, right? I remember I was playing Space Marines into Drakari, and I got to play three turns of a 5-turn game if I played very well. If I was doing a real good job, you know, I got to play 3 turns.
That matters. That does matter.
I play 5 turns.
Well, you know? I think what we're seeing now, especially as the edition matures, is faction specialist developing. Like, there are always going to be people that chase that bleeding edge of whatever they think the strongest and most efficient thing is. But then we got folks that we all know some folks that are really hammering out with certain factions and finding the tools to deal with these things to win some games.
Tanya's sparring partner, Mr. McDougal, is a great example. Another Canadian, Skari, despite Skari's faction right now being...
happens to be Drakari, but...
probably, it's when we step back and look at Drakari now, they've been the best army of the last, 18 months, For the term of 9th edition, they're the army that comes to mind as the one that's been in the top spot for the longest. But he's been playing that faction and almost nothing else except for some Black Templars, my bro. But for five, six, seven years?
Oh, long time. An absolute faction specialist. Been playing them even when they were lean on the win ratio.
Yeah, exactly right. And he's been fantastic and consistent with that faction through the dark times, through the great times. Same as Alex. Alex is the best player in that town. Doesn't matter how good the Hive Mind factions are going.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a bit of a diss.
I mean, it's just so funny when you get to experience that level of play on a fairly regular basis, and then you go to the next town over and they're talking about how bad Forces of the Hive Mind are and all of that, and you just
I just lost by 30 points.
Yeah, the first time that I played Alex after the Octarius supplement came out was a bloodbath, right? And it's just really hard to engage with people when their minds are so set on what is good and what is bad and the overall meta.
I do think the internet engages in that type of dialogue way more often than it should.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, another reason why that's something to maybe try to avoid is that people who are up and coming in a faction like myself with Guard and everybody just talks about how bad they are. It really does lead to a lot of low morale, right? If the top players can't make it work, well, then how am I ever supposed to make it work as well? So it's nice to see these sort of faction experts still out there killing it, putting in the wins, and it sort of just gives me hope. But But Alex is sort of been coaching me through my 2 years of not giving up on guard. And yeah, and he even agrees. He's like, it's probably time for you to try something else and just sort of reevaluate how you feel.
Play style. Yeah. I mean, it makes a difference too. Could be that this is the, you know, maybe how you entered the start of the journey might not be how your place you're at right now. And that's completely okay. And thankfully the game allows for that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I really feel like a lot of the people who give you advice and like, oh, just stick with your faction. You love it. And all of this, I feel like sometimes you need to step back and like see who's giving you that advice, because most of those people also play multiple factions. So if you want to branch out and try something else.
Well, this is a game. I know this goes without saying, but it's supposed to be fun. And the definition of that fun is going to change from time to time for the individual people. And if you are no longer satisfying the definition of entertainment and fun, but you still like some other aspects of it, then change it up. I mean, I absolutely support that with anybody that's out there. And if you are able to expand that to multiple armies, if someone's in a position to do that, then that is one of the surefire ways to inject some, you know, maybe a new lease on life or whatever to your hobby evening.
I think for me, like, winning isn't the fun part, but learning something new in every game, that's the fun part for me. And I was just getting to a point with Guard where I wasn't really learning that much more. And now I feel like with my new faction, I can learn some new stuff, and it's fun so far. So I'm just going to ride this train.
That sounds like a pretty good place to wrap it up. It's been another episode of Forge Narrative. Please don't forget to leave some 5-star reviews.
Yeah.
Adam, Tanya. y'all got anything else you want to throw out there before we wrap it up?
Play 40K every day.
Be nice, roll dice.
We're going to be closing out the Nova Open Charitable Foundation fall raffles this weekend, and an hour-long live stream where we'll announce some winners. So if you hear this before that, come check us out on the Nova Open Twitch page. Going to be going live.
Please do. It's such an amazing initiative that they put on, you know, year after year, almost season after season. And yeah, if you can go over and support them and support everything that they do, there are some phenomenal prizes for participation and raffle prizes up for grabs. Jump in, win yourself some awesome stuff. I've been a winner with those raffles before. I won a phenomenally cool Squig force. What was the force for Warcry? Or is it Underworlds? Yeah, absolutely beautifully painted. You know, I slung what I could afford to sling towards raffle tickets. Very happy to be a winner. Got a little coin as well, which was, I think, just as cool as the prize that I actually have in my bag for some reason. I've taken it with me back over here.
Okay.
Hopefully one day I can show it off.
And Adam, where can folks find you this weekend?
Oh, I'm going to be at I'm going to be in New Orleans. I've been looking forward to traveling to New Orleans for years. It's one of those cities. I feel like it's a destination city. I've always wanted to go. There's so much history, so much story. I want to eat the food too. I want to eat lots of that food, get real fat. Yeah. But I'm going to be at a Frontline Gaming event that's happening down there. 3 days. You can head on over to frontlinegaming.org. Also, War Games Live will be streaming. I'll be doing commentary. Jump involved, get involved. If you can, please go over and support the Nova Open Charitable Foundation as well. Maybe dual screen us. It's going to be a good time. Good weekend.
Throw some comments in there. All right, folks. We'll see y'all next week.
See you then.
Bye, everybody.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.